watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. How does a country become a tyranny? Incrementally. As Derek Jensen said in a talk previously aired on this show, at each incremental rise in oppression during the Third Reich, submission was made to look the lesser of evils. Heil the Führer or get beaten, carry an ID card or go to jail, get on the train or get shot. After gaining a foothold through a combination of election and intimidation, the Nazis engineered the Reichstag fire in order to put in place laws enabling totalitarian control. Though a, quote, foreign terrorist placed the bomb in the basement of the Reichstag, a Nazi official unlocked the doors so he could get in order that the event could be responded to by laws enabling dictatorship. It's important to remember that everything done in Hitler's Germany was perfectly within the law, as is always the case, because dictators make the laws and justify them in the name of national security. Then as now, the goal of the dictatorship is not national security, but their security. The ability to use the coercive apparatus of the state to give them and their allies power and wealth and to perpetuate it. The so-called war on terrorism is no different, and it has already shown who the state considers the real threat. Opponents of the administration and those who oppose corporate domination. Since the passage of the anti-terror laws, such as the Patriot Act, the laws have been used most visibly against environmentalists who have engaged in the destruction of corporate property. It's important to understand that corporations live in real terror of environmental groups and any organized public opposition. Even those who are not torching their genetically engineered tree farms or SUV dealerships. Any kind of opposition drives up the cost of doing business, causing delays that cut into profits, which are their reason for being. A corporation that is being visibly targeted, even by a boycott, will be deserted by stockholders out of fear of declining profits and will thus suffer a decline in its stock price. It's important to remember that most of the people in the corporate camp are in it for the money and are ultimately no match for opponents driven by passion for the earth, for freedom, for dignity, for the integrity of their community. Solidarity hones this vision into a potent weapon. As American revolutionist Benjamin Franklin said more than two centuries ago, "We must indeed all hang together, or most assuredly, we shall all hang separately." The only way that any tyranny has ever prevailed is when enough of the people were willing to cooperate with it. Driven by hysteria through ignorance, or looking to their own short-term advantage instead of the big picture. The increasing repression and surveillance of the population has been justified as a means to catch terrorists and criminals. But the real question is, who gets to define who is a terrorist or a criminal? On a previous show, I reported on the case of Walter F. Murphy, a law professor at Princeton University. Last March, he was denied a boarding pass at the Newark, New Jersey airport because he was told he was on the terrorist watch list. Murphy, a former Marine, was dumbfounded that he should be on such a list and even displayed his retired military benefits card to the airline clerk. The clerk asked him, "Have you been in any peace marches? We ban a lot of people from flying because of that." Murphy responded that he had never been in any marches, but that in September 2006 he'd given a lecture at Princeton, which was televised and put on the web, highly critical of George Bush for his many violations of the Constitution. To which the airline employee responded, "That'll do it." Murphy's case is not an isolated instance. Last year, 60 Minutes reported that it had obtained a copy of the no-fly list, which contained 44,000 names. Another companion list, containing about 75,000 names, flagged people who should be subjected to heightened security, namely searches when they try to board a plane. Some of the people who have appeared on this list have been high-profile opponents of the administration, journalists, whistleblowers, and public interest lawyers. In our ongoing readings from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, which we'll hear at the end of the show, documented the motives behind compulsory schooling in America, the social engineering of a population of compliant employees and predictable consumers who would not challenge the power and privileges of the plutocracy, the control and surveillance implemented under the rubric of the War on Terror has the same aims. When a few aim to keep control of many, it's important to nip resistance in the bud, to make an example of the most forward opponents in order to strike fear into the rest. To do this effectively, it's helpful to know who those opponents are and to neutralize them before they can organize. Enter high-tech surveillance, the subject of our first hour, where we'll deal with two facets: surveillance of phone and internet communications by the National Security Agency and the passage of the Real ID Act that, in effect, creates a national identity card which can be electronically scanned and cataloged into a database which allows the government to monitor the movements of each person, or even worse, control them. Such a card, combined with databases such as a no-fly list, can make it easy to bar all such persons from public transit, public and private buildings, banks, sports stadiums, stores, employment, any place where a card reader can be installed. The debate taking place in Congress and in the mainstream press over the Bush administration's use of the National Security Agency to do warrantless spying often tends to stress the fact that a warrant was not obtained, and thus so-called innocent Americans were spied upon illegally. Whether there is a warrant or not, my concern is to protect guilty Americans, guilty in the way Professor Murphy was guilty, those who reject the world being imposed upon us. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has formed a Technology and Liberty Project to defend against this expanding surveillance. This topic was the focus of their Washington State annual convention held last February. Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio recorded and emceed the keynote speeches by author James Bamford and Chris Calabrese, Program Counsel for ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project. That's what we're going to hear next. Here's Mike McCormick.
James Bamford is one of the plaintiffs in the ACLU's lawsuit challenging the NSA warrantless surveillance program. He is a journalist and best-selling author who has won acclaim for shedding light on the secretive National Security Agency, and you may be familiar with one of his books. His 1982 book, The Puzzle Palace, was such a comprehensive description of the NSA and its practices that the agency tried to suppress its publication. He followed up with more insights in 2001 with Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret NSA. Mr. Bamford spent 9 years as an investigative producer for ABC News. His articles on intelligence and national security issues appear regularly in publications such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and Atlantic Monthly. You will also hear from Chris Calabrese, program counsel of the National ACLU's Program on Technology and Liberty, where he's worked for 3 years. Mr. Calabrese has spoken and written on privacy and information technology cases and issues, including national ID card, data mining, and the ever-growing surveillance society. Mr. Calabrese also comes from experience dealing with legislative issues. He worked for the majority Senate leader in the Massachusetts legislature on issues regarding privacy. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to educate us today on these very important issues.
Thanks, Jesse, very much. And I appreciate being here with the ACLU of Washington. When I began writing on NSA many years ago, my first book, Puzzle Palace, came out in 1982, almost nobody had ever heard of NSA, and I don't mean just the public. For example, when I was doing the book tour, one of the people that I shared a car with going to one of the studios was Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey, and he was going to talk about the economy. I was going to talk about my book, and he said, what's your book about? And I said, it's about NSA, the National Security Agency. And he said, what's that? So I ended up spending 15 minutes explaining to the senior senator from New Jersey what the largest intelligence agency was. And then when we got on the program, the first question the host asked was, how secret is NSA? And I just couldn't resist it. I said, even Senator Bradley said he'd never heard of it. And he took a separate car back to the hotel after that. And the next day, his aide called up and said, that was sort of below the belt. And I said, what do you mean? He's a senator. He should know what the largest intelligence agency is. And I said, if I wanted to hit him below the belt, I would have said he probably confused it with the NBA, being a basketball star. So it was a very secret agency at the very beginning. It's still very secret. One other thing, my book got selected as one of the selections for Book of the Month Club. So, you know, like everybody that gets selected, you look at the back of the New York Times Book Review and there's a little, you know, picture of your jacket there with all the other books. And I saw mine. I really couldn't believe it because it said, The Puzzle Palace, a report on NASA, America's most secret agency. Because the ad agency thought I had made a mistake on my own book since they had never heard of NSA. So they voluntarily changed it. So NSA's gotten a bit more of a profile today, thanks to the ACLU suit, of which I'm a plaintiff. I have to really thank the ACLU because they've come to my rescue numerous times. When I did the Puzzle Palace, the Justice Department threatened me with prosecution because I wouldn't give back certain documents that were given to me by the Attorney General under the Carter administration. And when the Reagan administration came in, they demanded I give them back because they didn't want the information coming out. They were documents that showed illegal activity on the part of NSA. So I refused to give them back, and the ACLU provided me with a very good attorney, and we fought the government, and we won. And the material was in my book. And then the NSA and the Justice Department went down to one of the libraries I used and began pulling stuff off the shelves that I'd quoted from and locking it away. And again, the ACLU went down and launched a suit along with the American Historical Association, American Library Association. And now again, the ACLU and I are together on suing NSA over violating Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which I'll get into in my little talk here. So what I'm going to talk about today is this whole area of surveillance, NSA surveillance. And I thought what might be useful is just to give a background, because people don't really have much of a background on how prevalent NSA surveillance, NSA and its predecessor agencies, how much their surveillance has been, domestic surveillance over the years, and how little it's ever complied with the law. So let me get into this, this little slide presentation. Yeah, so I hope you all have clearance here. It's a top secret code word. So this is the NSA, the National Security Agency. Actually, the symbol of the NSA is that little skeleton key. which means they want to get into everybody's most private doors and so forth. Very appropriate, I think. That's the NSA. It's the largest intelligence agency in the world. It's the most secret intelligence agency also. It's occupies an entire city. It's about three times the size of the CIA. Far more secret. There's books virtually every week on the CIA. There's only been two books ever published on NSA, and I wrote both of them. Nobody from NSA has ever written a book. It's an extremely secret agency. They do the... it's the largest, most intrusive agency in the country, and it also has the world's largest collection of supercomputers. This is an idea of the extent of it. It's hard to see it all, but it's virtually an entire city. It's a city that consists of more than 50 buildings. They have their own police department, their own fire department. They even have their own film festival there once a year. I mean, it's a very interesting place. I'm one of the few people that have been through it a number of times, and for a lot of reasons, I've been in and out of there a number of times. I mean, they actually, threatened me with prosecution in my first book, and then when my second book came out, they actually had a book signing for me at NSA. So, I sort of alternate. I'm a good guy, then I'm a bad guy, I'm a good guy, I'm a bad guy. Now I'm suing NSA again, so now I'm a bad guy again. So. Again, this is the inside of NSA. It's an agency that very few people have heard about, and they like to keep it that way. It's the only agency that's basically excluded from the Freedom of Information Act. Before it was a big city, it was a small... This is how it began, basically, back in around 1920. This building on your left there was the home of the American Black Chamber. That was the original name of what the predecessor to NSA was. That was the interception and code-breaking organization back in 1920. And they fit the entire organization into this one brownstone apartment building in New York City. The person who ran it was Herbert O. Yardley, who had run MI8, which was a code-breaking organization during World War I. And then he headed the civilian organization, this Black Chamber, beginning around 1920. It was an extremely secret agency secret organization during the 1920s. The problem Yardley had was after World War I. During World War I, they had censorship, so everything the communications companies produced had to go to the government by law. After World War I, censorship ended, so that meant where was the Black Chamber now going to get its all its information to read, all the telegrams and everything? So Yardley had to go out and make a secret agreement with Western Union and the other telegraph companies so that Western Union, again, this is a very secret, very illegal agreement. He had to go out personally and meet with the presidents of these companies. And he got the cooperation of these companies. And there was usually only about two or three people in the company that knew that the companies at Western Union was turning all this information over to the Black Chamber. That lasted all through the 1920s until 1929, and then somebody by the name of Henry Stimson came along. Henry Stimson was Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover, and he came up with probably the most famous quote in American cryptology. It was, "Americans do not read each other's mail." And again, this is 1929, and he shut down the Black Chamber, and that was the end of Herbert Yardley. He went on to write a book called The American Black Chamber. So it ended in 1929, and then with the attack on Pearl Harbor, World War II came, and all of a sudden Henry Stimson is now Secretary of War, and now he's very anxious for the government to read others' mail, which wasn't any problem during World War II, just like World War I, because they had censorship, so the government had to turn over all that information. Then after World War II, Preston Quarterman, who was chief of what the Black Chamber became what was known as the SSA, the Signal Security Agency. And he was faced with the same problem Herbert Yardley was faced with, which was, how do you get these messages? How do you get these telegrams, all this communication, now that censorship had ended? So, again, he had to do the same thing. He had to make these secret deals with the telecommunications companies. He had to go back to Western Union and all the other all the other telecommunications companies and arrive at a very, very secret, very, very illegal agreement. The presidents of these companies, the chairman of the board, there were only maybe five people in each company that would know that these companies were cooperating. The one things that they couldn't get were the singing telegrams. So, but all the other telegrams went to the SSA, which was the predecessor to NSA. So in 1952, the NSA was formed. It was a consolidation of all the other agencies within the government that did this interception, the Signal Security Agency, the Army Security Agency, Naval Security Group, a bunch of others. They all came together and formed this big, big secret National Security Agency. And unlike other agencies like the CIA, which went through Congress and was a product of debate and hearings and so forth, NSA was formed by a very, very secret memorandum signed by President Truman in November 1952. Even its name was top secret. There are only two people in Congress that were ever who were ever informed that this agency was created. So it operated in absolute secrecy from 1952 on. After about 10 years, it started leaking out that there was this agency, and its name got out, and they created a sort of a cover story for it. And so NSA inherited this cable interception program. It was codenamed Shamrock. This was the cooperation with the telecommunications companies to turn over all the communications going in, coming out, or going through those companies, including Western Union. And it was moved to an office building in New York City. This is a generic photo. I don't know where the exact office building was. They're still keeping that very secret. But the NSA office was masqueraded in a office building in New York City as a television tape processing company. And what would happen would be that an agent from NSA, after midnight every night, would go to the back door of a Western Union and the other telegraph companies, and the companies would turn over all the computerized tapes of all the telegrams coming in, going out, or going through the United States that day. And yeah, I mean, when I was back in law school, if any agency like this is FBI or the DEA wanted to get a single telegram, they'd have to go to a court and get a judge and who'd issue a warrant. But this was all telegrams going to NSA without ever getting a warrant. So an agent would go to the back door, get the telegrams, the whole batch of computer tapes, take them to the television tape processing company, NSA's secret office, make duplicates of all those tapes throughout the night, and then get the originals back to NSA by the or get the originals back to the companies by the early morning before the shift ends, so nobody else would have to know that all this is being given to NSA. And then NSA would take all that material and ship it the next morning, that morning, to NSA headquarters. They did it by train. They were always afraid of putting them on a plane with a courier and having the plane crash, and then all of a sudden people finding all these tapes of all these telegrams. So they put them on a train and they sent them to NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, and they run all those tapes through this supercomputer known as the Harvest Computer, which was appropriately named. This is a picture of the Harvest Computer. It was probably one of the very first supercomputers in the United States, and the programs in the computer would be loaded with the names of Americans, names of people that they were interested, targets. They'd have addresses, they'd have phrases people might use. And then any name that was in the computer that had been mentioned in a telegram that day or any kind of a communication that they intercepted would be kicked out. And again, this was all illegal because there was never any warrant that was ever applied for this. All that was kept secret from 1945, basically, until 1975. Nobody knew that the NSA was doing this. I mean, even presidents didn't know. One funny incident was that Richard Nixon, during Watergate, called in the director of NSA into his office, into the Oval Office, and said, I'm concerned about the influence of foreign influence in the anti-war movement, so I want NSA to begin eavesdropping domestically. Well, they've been doing it for the last 25 years, and he didn't know it. And then J. Edgar Hoover, who was angry over NSA getting onto its turf territory, told the president, you know, he better stop NSA doing this eavesdropping or he's basically going to blow the whistle. So after a week, Nixon stopped the program. He called up NSA and said, you know, stop the program. Well, NSA had been doing it before they got the White House permission, and they just kept doing it after. So it made no difference. Anyway, in 1975, there was a big investigation into the Intelligence Committee led by Senator Frank Church, called the Church Committee. That's Senator Church with a gun in his hand there. That's actually a gun that they found, assassination device they got from the CIA. So Church held his hearings, and that's when they found out about all these NSA eavesdropping activities. And, you know, both sides of the aisle were outraged. The Democrats and the Republicans were both equally outraged for, you know, justified reasons. None of them knew that the NSA was doing this illegal spying. So one of the solutions they came up with was creating a very secret court to handle warrants. The Democrats wanted the NSA to go through normal procedures. You know, you want to eavesdrop on somebody, you go to a court, you get a warrant, and you do it. The Republicans didn't want any kind of restrictions. So the compromise was to create a separate court system, a very, very secret court system that would only listen to these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrants, and the judges would have all the top clearances. They decided to put the location of the court. They kept it secret. It's still supposedly secret, but, you know, secret's out. It's on the top floor of the Justice Department building. And that's where the secret court is. It's a it's in a windowless, bug-proof room with guards out in front. It doesn't look much like a courtroom. It's basically a got a conference table and so forth, people that sit in front of it. This is the court in session. I managed to get a secret photo of the court actually doing work. there actually has never been a picture ever taken inside the court, so this will have to do. Now, the government comes in and argues, the NSA and the FBI go in and argue for a warrant before the court, and the court almost always, I mean, you could really bet the farm on the fact that they'll agree to it. And from 1979, when they had their first session, to 2000, they had over 13,000 applications, and out of that, there were only two warrants that the court asked to be modified. After the Bush administration came in, they were really asking for outrageous things, and it went up to 175, which is one of the reasons why they decided to go around the court. So normally, I mean, it's a very easy court to get these warrants from. In 30 years, they've only turned down, I think, five warrants the most. But if the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, turns down the government has a right to appeal to another very secret court. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Court of Review, which, again, almost nobody's ever heard of. But it consists of three appeals court judges that have never, almost never have heard a case. They've only heard one case in 30 years. So they're sort of the Maytag repairmen of the federal judiciary system. So they've heard this one case, and they did side in the favor of the government. But even if the government gets turned down at the Foreign Intelligence Court of Review, the government has another bite at the apple, a third bite at the apple. They can go to the Supreme Court for an immediate in-camera session of the Supreme Court to have them decide. And again, all these are ex parte in-camera. In other words, only the government and in total secrecy. So the odds of not getting a FISA warrant are, you know, almost impossible. This had been the chief judge of the FISA court when at the time 9/11 and soon after that when the NSA decided to go around the court. This is the current presiding judge of the FISA court. Now, just to give and again the whole idea here and the reason that, you know, we're suing NSA is because the NSA decided on orders of the president to bypass that court, to bypass this very onerous court that almost never turns them down, and where they've got, you know, multiple opportunities to get the warrant. Just to give you, I want to give you a little idea of how NSA does its work and why, to some degree, that there's the NSA decided to go around the court for the technical reasons as opposed to the political reasons. During the Cold War, this is the way NSA eavesdropped. I mean, this is an interesting photo here. During the 1950s, before they had satellites in space, the NSA was trying to figure out ways to eavesdrop on communications inside Russia, particularly microwave communications, which travel in a straight line. I don't want to get into the technology here, but just two things. Microwaves travel in a straight line. High-frequency signals bounce off the ionosphere and bounce around the world. High-frequency signals they could collect outside of the Soviet Union with antennas. Microwaves, you can't. They go straight up. So they're going into deep space. So somebody at NSA figured that if they're going into deep space, the moon passes over the Earth, you know, once a day, and occasionally these signals will hit the moon. And there's a crater on the moon that's fairly smooth. So the signals will hit this crater, and then they'll ricochet back to the Earth. So they built these. They built an enormous dish. It's now called the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico. But they built this enormous dish originally. This was a very secret reason. Nobody realizes why they were building it in the first place. To collect these signals as they bounced off the moon, so you could, from Puerto Rico, this big dish in the ground, eavesdrop on communications in the center of Russia. But that's what NSA does. It finds all these fantastic technological ways to eavesdrop. And again, during the Cold War, what they were listening to most of the time from Russia was high-frequency communications. That's what the Soviet Army, Soviet Navy, Soviet Air Force communicated on. And these were dedicated lines. These were communications where when you tap into these frequencies, that's all you're listening to, are Russian communications. So it's very easy. And this is how they did most of it. These were these huge circular antennas. They were called Willenweber antennas, or their nickname was the elephant cage antennas, because they were gigantic antennas that looked like elephant cages. And that's what they were doing during the Cold War. And that was for Russian communications. To eavesdrop on international communications, telephone calls, the kind of communications we're involved on, they focused largely on satellite communications. As I said, microwaves travel in a straight line. So if you're in Moscow and you want to communicate to the Far East in Russia, the signal will go over a microwave, and it'll go from terminal to terminal. Every 20 miles, there'll be a repeater station. And that's because the Earth is curved, and because the signal travels in a straight line, it'll go into deep space. Well, that means that if you want to eavesdrop on that signal, one way of doing it is putting a satellite into geostationary orbit, 22,330 miles in space, where it sits over one area. And so that, those signals will go direct to that satellite. So anyway, by putting a satellite in the right place in space, you're able to eavesdrop on telephone calls on the Earth. And to a large degree, you get a better reception. NSA was able to listen to those calls in a clearer reception and to some degree faster than the actual recipients of the calls themselves. So that's how NSA did this during the Cold War. Largely in terms of communications satellites, by eavesdropping on them from space and also on ground. This is an NSA listening post at Menwith Hill Station in the UK, a very, very secret NSA base in the UK. And each of those radomes has a big satellite dish under it, and it's listening to a satellite. It could be a Russian government satellite. It could be a communications satellite. The radomes hide the direction in which the satellites the dishes are pointed, so you don't know which satellite they're pointed to. But an average major listening post, like the one at Menwith Hill Station, which is run by NSA in England, and if you have these major stations at three different points on the Earth, you're able to collect most of the satellite communications around the world. An average, you know, major NSA station will pick up 2 million pieces of communications an hour. That's telephone calls, email, faxes, cellular calls, whatever. And that's what's flowing into these dishes right now. And then once they go into the dishes, there's some initial processing. They get rid of, you know, they're not really interested in communications to and from Liechtenstein or other places, Andorra, some other countries. So they eliminate some of the stuff that they're not interested in, and then they send the remainder back to NSA. And again, these are just some pictures of NSA listening posts. They're usually very hidden, and when people see them, you know, it looks like some moon base that all of a sudden appeared. Now, the reason for some of the problems that everybody's getting into right now in terms of why the NSA is changing is because of change in technology. Telecommunications companies have decided to not really use satellite communications as much anymore for a number of reasons. There's a time delay, there's a half-second time delay for a signal to go up to a satellite and come down. That's distracting when you're making phone calls. There's atmospheric conditions and so forth. And organizations like cable TV companies want to use these satellites where they don't care about time delay. So as a result, there's been a change in technology where they use these fiber optic cables. These are cables where light is transmitted on these very thin, hair-thin fibers, glass fibers. It's an enormous change in telecommunications. And so now if you're going to call, well, previously if you're going to call from London to New York, the signal would go up to a satellite, bounce down to a ground station in Edom, West Virginia, and then be transmitted up to New York. Now the signal would go from London to what they call a landing station in England, and it'd go on a fiber optic cable under the Atlantic Ocean and then come up on a landing station either in New Jersey or New York. The problem for NSA with that is that when it was satellite communications, all they had to do was put a big dish out there and it would collect all the signals they were interested in. They didn't have to have any cooperation from the telecommunications companies because the signals would just fall into their big dishes and NSA would listen to them all. With a shift to fiber optics, that meant the NSA can't collect it by just putting dishes out there anymore. They've now got to make a secret cooperation with the telecommunications companies. They've got to get the telecommunications companies, just like Yardley in World War I and General Quarterman in World War II. They've got to go out and talk to the telecommunications companies and get their secret permission to get access to the cable. And that's what's happened. There's the cable companies are now cooperating with the NSA in terms of giving them access to the cable. They have what's known as sort of a beam splitter. So when the cable comes in, there's a mirror image that gets routed off to and this is a, you can see how widespread the fiber optic cable systems are around the world now. There's basically two ways to tap into a fiber optic cable. One is the USS Jimmy Carter, which was specially designed to go to the bottom of the ocean and tap into these cables. It's very difficult, very time-consuming, very expensive, and not very efficient, but they do it in places where they don't have access to the companies and the cables. The only other way is by having these cooperation. So what happens is you get places like AT&T, and they agree, again, just like Yardley during World War I, Quarterman during World War II, now, after the attack on World War, after the 9/11 attacks, you got this cooperation again, and now you have the NSA getting the cooperation of AT&T and these other companies to put these secret rooms. This is actually an actual photo of the NSA secret room in the AT&T facility out in California, and this is another suit. There's two major suits: the ACLU versus NSA, which is one I'm a part of, and there's a second suit, the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is suing the telecommunications companies for giving their telecommunications to NSA. And that's what this is all about. It's the establishment of these secret rooms, which are getting mirror images of all the telecommunications traffic. And I'm talking about millions and millions of communications an hour. And then it's sent from there off to NSA. So where before they used to have these big dishes collecting it all, sending off to NSA, now they they're beginning to have these secret rooms. And these are the issues that the ACLU and EFF and a number of other organizations are alarmed about and bringing suit about. So it's a very dangerous situation because all this is illegal right now. The technology has gone way beyond where the law is, and the whole idea right now is to find a way to have the law catch up with the technology so that these things are regulated by laws and they don't go outside of law. One other area that they're getting into are internet data hubs, for example. NSA, in order to get into the internet, if you're talking about email and the internet, it's not all this, everything in the ether there. There are hubs where all this stuff comes through. And if you tap into the hubs, you're able to get a huge variety of that communications. So these are in various places around the United States. They're not heavily publicized or these huge windowless buildings. But those are the other things. And it's in addition to the telephone calls, they're interested in getting access to these nodes, these internet nodes around the around the country and around the world. So that's sort of a short summary of the area we're in now in terms of a surveillance society and why these suits, like the one by the ACLU, are very important, because if the ACLU isn't suing NSA, nobody else would be suing them. And if nobody sues them, nobody's going to force them to change anything. The suit was very successful. In August of last year, the judge in the case, Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit, found that NSA was in violation of the law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a criminal statute, and also in violation of the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. So now we're at the appeal stage, and we have to see where it goes from here, and then the Supreme Court. But that's why I'm very grateful to the ACLU for taking on these difficult challenges, because again, if they didn't do it, nobody would do it. And I appreciate all your support here for ACLU and for your attention here. And after we finish our talks here, I'd be happy to take questions. So, thank you very much.
We're now going to hear, thank you, first of all.
Pleasure.
We're now going to hear from Chris Calabresi, and we will have a short question and answer period after this.
Well, let me just start by saying thank you to the ACLU. Yep, not putting my pen there. Thank you to the ACLU of Washington for having me out and for talking about these issues, which are becoming increasingly prevalent. Jim has really given the parade example of where we are going in terms of surveillance and a surveillance society. I mean, what the NSA is doing with the cooperation of the telecommunications companies is really what the military industrial complex was of the 50s. Today we have a surveillance industrial complex that's doing a very similar thing, that's bringing industry together with government to spy on all of us. We're going to talk a lot more about that at the next panel in the next, couple of hours. And I look forward to bringing out some more examples and hopefully sort of letting you see what this big picture means, not just for surveillance and the NSA, but for all the technologies that we use on a day-to-day basis and many of the ones that we'll see in the future. I'd like to take a brief couple of minutes here, because I'm sure you're going to have questions for Jim, but to talk a little bit about another way, a completely different way, but one that's also immediately pressing, for having the government track and follow each of us, and that is the national ID card. We've begun to look at the way that communication is tracked and surveilled as a way that the government can keep close tabs on us. Well, of course, the other way that, the NSA, the FBI, would like to keep track of us is our physical location and our movements and our habits. So not just what we're saying, but what we're doing. And in In furtherance of that goal, in 2005, Congress passed, essentially without debate and as part of a much larger spending bill, the Real ID Act of 2005. Now, the Real ID Act essentially federalizes the state driver's license. What it says is that in order for you as a citizen to use your driver's license to get on a plane or enter a federal facility, by 2008, your driver's license must meet a series of federal standards. These standard, basically, and essentially what that means is the licenses must have a standardized type of information on them. They must have a standardized machine-readable element on the back so that, you know, a common, for like a barcode or a mag stripe, so that one common machine can read all the information off the back of your card. And a standardized database that links them all the IDs throughout the country. So what you have here is essentially the fiction of a state ID card. It will look the same on the, it will look a little different on the outside in Arizona and New Mexico and New Jersey, but it will be the same card from day to day. And Real ID gives DHS the power to not only apply this card to requiring it to get on an airplane, to enter a federal facility, but for any other purpose that the Department of Homeland Security should desire. So you can quickly assume that your Real ID card will be necessary to open a bank account, for instance. It may someday be necessary to cash your Social Security check, to apply for Medicaid or Medicare. Federal functions will be contingent upon you being able to provide your national ID card. Well, what's the big deal? I mean, we all present driver's licenses for a lot of purposes, in our day-to-day lives. So, what's the big deal if it's federalized? Basically, by standardizing your driver's license, you're enabling a number of things that we at the ACLU think are bad. You're enabling, first of all, the tracking of individuals. It becomes much easier to record where you've gone. You swipe that card when you go to the when you present your card when you go to the airport to fly. You swipe that card when potentially you get on a train, when you enter a federal facility, when you buy something. We've now removed any question about who you might be. There's no doubt of the Chris Calabrese in question now. It's in a common format, and it can be shared in a common way. So what you have is then the ability to aggregate the massive amounts of information that are already out there about you, information that's collected by banks, insurance companies, private corporations. To give you a very prosaic example from my own life, if you want to cash in your warranty, for example, at Best Buy, your DVD player breaks, as mine did a couple of years ago. Of course, I didn't keep the receipt, but I'm lucky because Best Buy did. They keep a profile on every single thing that you purchase from Best Buy with your credit card. They keep a nice, a file, and if you want to get your receipt or your, find out what you've purchased, you can call Best Buy and they'll send it to you. Which is nice, it's convenient. It also, of course, lets them track exactly what you're purchasing and sell better to you. But as it turns out, I'm from Queens. I live in Queens, New York. There are two Chris Calabreses in Queens, and Best Buy has confused us. So, their Best Buy's profile of Chris Calabrese in Queens has, the other guy's address, the other guy's phone number, some of my information, and all of our purchases mushed together. Now, this actually worked to my advantage because he bought a DVD player a month after I did, so the warranty was still. But, in general, you could see how this would bother an intelligence gathering agency, for instance. They're really not keen on having different Chris Calabreses and Mike Smiths all mushed together. They'd like to keep them separate, clear. The Real ID Act and the National ID Card does that. And so when you have all this information, it's collected at Walmart, it's collected at Target. When you pay with a credit card, they'll want to see your driver's license just for security purposes. Then they'll swipe it, and then they'll give it back to you. And then they'll know exactly what you bought, and there'll be no doubt about who you are. The other scary part is, and the connection I think we'll make more clearly as the day goes on, is we're not just talking about surveillance here. we're also talking about control. Because surveillance is really, it's not just about watching you. It's about controlling what you do and how you move. It's about, you know, Jim has talked about some of the surveillance, and we'll get into the details of thinking about what it means to have your emails read, to have your phone tapped, what it does to how you behave. Well, a national ID card isn't just a way to monitor your movements, it's a way to control them. You know, you need that ID card to get on a plane. You may need it soon to get on a train. And when you couple that with another, you know, widespread and terrible practice, which is, of course, government watch lists, you have lists, they're, you know, about 300,000 long right now, though they're secret lists, so nobody really knows how big they are. But when you combine those things, you have lists of people who the government doesn't think is dangerous enough to arrest, but still suspicious. So we're going to make the list of those people, and then when you build a unified system for tracking those people, you also have a unified system of control. I don't want Chris Calabrese to get on a train. He's on a watch list. Let's, you know, give him additional searches. Let's make sure that, you know, we watch him more carefully. So, I mean, this is the bad news. The good news, of course, is that Real ID is a really stupid law, not just in its impact on privacy, thankfully, but just in general. It envisions a system whereby every American has to go to the DMV and present, like, four what we would call breeder documents, things that kind of prove who you are, like your birth certificate, a Social Security card, things that you would go into proving your identity. And each of those pieces of documentation has to be verified with the source agency. So if I'm, you know, my birth certificate from Tarrytown, New York, somehow you have to find a way to prove if I go to get a, you know, California license that this is a real birth certificate from Tarrytown, New York. All that information has to be, all those identity documents have to be scanned and stored. All the IT systems for driver's license companies have to be standardized so that the driver's license, you know, we have to create this massive database. Well, as it turns out, this is really, really expensive to do, about $11 billion in startup money alone. It's also really, really cumbersome. I mean, you're talking about changing state IT systems for driver's license, many of which date back to the 70s. You know, you're talking about putting people through in extraordinary burdens and waiting in long lines to verify their license. So, and of course, the federal government has provided no money to do this. This will shock you. But yes, the president's budget for this year contains exactly $0 for complying with a law that's supposed to be in effect next year. So states have been pushing back and pushing back very effectively, saying, you know, we're not going to comply. Just last month, the state of Maine said, not only are we not going to comply with the Real ID Act, we urge Congress to reject it. And we urge Congress to repeal it. At least 20 other states, including Washington, have followed that lead, have a variety of different pieces of legislation aimed at rejecting the Real ID Act, saying, you know, we're not going to do this, we're not going to pay for it. And our hope is that we will be able, that Congress, hearing this crescendo of complaints and, frankly, not being willing to, you know, give the states the money or the resources to do it themselves, will be forced to scale back the national driver's license and scale back the national ID. You know, it's going to be a little tricky. The things that the states care about and a lot of people care about are not necessarily the things that we as privacy advocates care about. But we have good lobbyists in Congress, and I hope that we'll be able to make that transition to a, you know, perhaps a more secure license, but one that doesn't impinge all of our privacy. I can't tell you what the number of your Washington bill is, because I'm not allowed to lobby under federal law, but I'm sure somewhere out there you can find, in the tables outside, you can find information on the Washington Act if you'd like to act yourself. I can also tell you about our website. It's called realnightmare.org, and it has a lot of information, you know, to tell you more about Real ID. So I'll just conclude by saying that I look forward to talking more about the surveillance society with you as the day goes on and let you ask Jim questions, because I'm sure that's really what you want to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. We do have about 15 minutes for questions, and so please proceed with any questions you have. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Michelle Kammerer from Bellingham. Question for Mr. Steinhardt. We're very concerned because we go to Canada all the time. What's going to happen with this all this requirements for people to have passports, and how does that interface with the real ID?
Sure. There's a separate congressional law. It's called the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, which requires a sort of better than your driver's license form of identification for crossing the border. It's actually separate from Real ID, but a lot of people have tried to conflate them. They've tried to say, well, why don't we turn Real ID into this kind of super travel document? And it simply illustrates, I think, that what this national ID card is going to turn into. It's going to morph into your ultimate travel document. We believe that the two issues should be kept separate, first of all, because we're trying to repeal Real ID, and also because no Real ID card will be ready for the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative target date, which is in February, I believe, of 2008. But I don't think, to answer your question directly, that the last chapter has been written on WIDI, because it's another example of government overreaching and bureaucracy and ID cards. It's, 25% of Americans right now have passports, expecting the other 75% or a significant portion of them to get them in the next year so that they can, cross the border seems unrealistic. And I would be surprised, if the Chambers of Commerce, if congressmen and governors from the states allow that to be the last word on crossing the border.
Thank you. We're going to go over to this microphone.
Hi, I have a question for Mr. Bamford. Yeah, obviously it's quite disconcerting to people that are concerned about privacy to think that the government is reading all the telegrams, reading all the emails, listening to all the phone calls and all of this. And clearly we can't have any confidence that they're going to follow the law and not just circumvent it secretly as they've done in the past. So what are people to do that are concerned about privacy issues? Is there a solution to that problem, such as encryption, such as PGP or some of these anonymous networks like Freenet or Tor? Do those actually work, or are those also easily tapped into?
Yeah, just in case people didn't hear the question, was given that the government and NSA and so forth are doing all this eavesdropping, are there ways to fight back, in essence, to help prevent that? Yeah, there's several ways. In terms of the political way, is to support groups that are fighting it, such as the ACLU and a number of state courts around the country. And in terms of the technical way, the best way is encryption. If you can get telecommunications companies to get secure point-to-point encryption for communications over their lines, then it makes, and providing that the key isn't given to NSA or whatever, that makes it secure, or if a person uses encryption themselves. The problem with using encryption yourself is that, whoever you communicate with has to have a key or has to be working on the same system to some degree, so it's not